Hello, and welcome to the Olympic and Bundy podcast. I'm Kelly Taylor. Today on the show is Doug Minnick, co-owner of a micro winery here in Southern California, and someone who is helping to bring smaller artisan winemakers in front of consumers at the Garagiste festivals around California. He loves wine, but not in that, you know, kind of snobby, intimidating kind of way. The name of his winery, for example, is Hoi Polloi, which translated means the common people, if you will. The name of the festival he co-founded, Garagiste, is a French term that was originally used to kind of degrade poor, smaller lot winemakers, you know, sometimes making wine in their garage and flipping it, taking ownership of the word. It's all very punk rock. I learned a lot about wine, and I hope you do too. Enjoy.
From the Fox 11 studios in Los Angeles, California, it's the Olympic and Bundy podcast with host Kelly Taylor.
Thank you for coming in. I know that driving anytime when it's daylight in Los Angeles can be kind of a feat. So I always appreciate it when people make the trek here.
My pleasure.
So on the way up here, we were talking about how you were in the music industry. You were working at a building across the street from where the Garagiste Festival is.
Mm-hmm.
Most of your career, you were working in music, right?
Correct.
Well, actually, before we get into this, let's open the bottle that you brought.
All right.
Just so we can have some conversation with some Pinot Noir.
Why not? Hoi Polloi Pinot Noir from Santa Maria, California. It's called Illicit. There's a story about that if we get into it.
Yeah, let's get into it now.
All right, so most of our wines, most of the Hoi Polloi wines have a vineyard designation on them because we source our fruit from the best vineyards we can find and want people to know that. There you go.
Yes.
Beautiful sound. And this one does not have a vineyard designation because there are winemakers that pour at the Garagiste Festival that I have come to know and whose wines I've come to love. And one of the guys there makes some of the best Pinot I've ever had. And so I went to him and I said, hey, is there any chance next harvest I could get some of that fruit? Do you think you'll have any extra fruit? And he said, kind of under his breath with a glance sideways, yeah, I can probably get you some fruit, but you can't tell anybody where you got it.
Keep it on the down low,
Doug. Because it's from one of these vineyards that's so high end that they have to approve the winemakers who make wine out of their vineyard. And my friend is the guy with the contract with them, and he's not allowed to sub the fruit out. So he said, I'll get it for you, but you swore me to secrecy, and that's why this wine is called Illicit instead of having a vineyard designation on it. So
I love that.
Yeah, then we sent it in for a score. We got a nice 92 score from the Wine Enthusiast magazine, and I think we passed their test now, so we can probably name the vineyard next time we release one.
I feel like this wine is kind of fits right in with your whole winery's kind of, it encompasses the brand, right? Kind of like going against the grain a little bit, sort of just doing it.
Yeah, a little bit renegade, a little bit guerrilla with a G-U-E.
Do a lot of growers have that mentality to where they have to accept what wineries are going to, you know, use their grapes?
Well, they make choices, I guess. This is sort of on the radical end of, you know, having to, you know, send them wine. They have to taste it first before they'll agree to sell you the grapes. And so they're a little bit on the extreme side. But it's common for winemakers of our size, small wineries, to source fruit from outside vineyards.
Yeah.
And that's really a big part of making great wine. When we were first getting started, one of my early winemaking mentors said, the key to making great wine, get great fruit and don't screw it up. So we've got the get great fruit part and we're trying not to screw it up.
Gotcha. So it really matters to have good grapes.
Yes. You cannot make good wine from bad fruit.
Gotcha. You can't like science it up and make it good.
Nope.
You got to start with good grapes.
Yep.
Interesting. Let's pour some.
Yep.
Patrick, do you like wine? I'm one of the people that kind of exists on the peripheral of wine culture, you know, kind of, I like it, don't know much about it. I feel like a lot of people are sort of like that, you know?
Well, you know, as we all are at some point.
Thank you.
Sure. Who, Was there a particular person or, you know, someone in your family that was really into wine? Or did you sort of start drinking it later in life?
I was a beer guy for years and years and years. So, yeah, it was, I'd say, probably about 20, 25 years ago when I just started getting interested in it. And then a friend of mine, actually Lisa Dinsmore, who's our event director, was getting seriously into it. And I learned a lot from her.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's dangerous information. The more wine you drink and the better wine you drink and the more expensive wine you drink, you tend not to turn around and go back in the other direction.
Right.
So that's kind of what happened to us. And we finally got so obsessed with it that we went from drinking it to making it.
Because you were like, I can't afford this.
Yeah, right.
Expensive, you know?
See, I can't afford this, so let's spend 100 times as much.
I like that. Well, cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you very much. Let's taste some.
And it is 5 o'clock somewhere, right? Even though it's
sun
is not over the yardarm here yet.
It's always 5 o'clock for me. So you were working for A&R Records.
A&M.
Did I read that? A&M.
Mm-hmm.
A&M. What'd you do there? You did a lot of things, right?
Yeah, I started in the mailroom, moved up into the publishing department, which is we work with songwriters and bands. So I was we had staff songwriters that I was responsible for pitching their songs to other artists to do, and we also were signing artists and bands to the publishing company, and then we would develop and take them on and get them signed to other labels.
Gotcha. What kind of bands were you working with?
Oh, gosh. I signed the writers who wrote Whitney Houston's first two number one records, How Will I Know and I Just Want to Dance with Somebody. Worked with Bryan Adams there. I always draw a blank. It seems like another person in another lifetime. It was so long ago. I really draw a blank on this stuff.
Who are just some of your go-to favorite bands or musicians that you would put on, like on the drive home? Who would be someone you'd like to listen to?
Well, I'm a Beatle freak. I mean, I go to Liverpool on vacation. Okay, so
nice.
that's number one. And then, I can't get enough Weezer. Those guys have never recorded a bad song.
I have a story about Weezer.
Oh, let's hear it.
My husband and I are pretty obsessed with the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Okay.
And there was a while where something would come up and we couldn't see them in concert. For whatever reason, there would always be something, like a graduation or a wedding, and whenever they would be in town, or, you know, we couldn't afford tickets, whatever. So we couldn't go. And then first off, going back, my husband and his dad were, they always play just Red Hot Chili Peppers live in concert on YouTube and like put it on the TV.
Mm-hmm.
It's just one of the like favorite pastimes, just kind of like come home, you know, a little bit tipsy, kind of rocking out to whatever they're playing. And they got the idea to look for, to see if they were touring, and kind of drunkenly bought tickets. So they see that they're going to be in Long Beach, and pretty close up, maybe like fourth or fifth row, the tickets are $40, which should have been a red flag.
Oh. Okay.
So they buy 6 tickets, and they live in my father-in-law lives in Cincinnati, so he's like, all right, we're gonna fly everyone out, we're gonna go to Long Beach, whatever. And the next day, Cole, my husband, gets an email, and it's, you know, receipt for the tickets, and he's like, oh, it's the Red Hot Chili Pipers, and like a bagpipe band that's just, you know, just like using their name to obviously cash in.
I think you've got a lawsuit there.
Yeah. Oh. So his dad is so funny, and he's telling all our friends, like, he doesn't have the heart to tell him. And he's like, that night we go somewhere, we're in town, we're going out, and he says to our other friend, like telling everyone, bragging about how he found the cheapest tickets. So we finally break it to him. He's bummed, but whatever. And we ended up going to the Red Hot Chili Pipers. And it was fun. They were great. They're just a bagpipe cover band. And after the show, they come out just to... It was a small enough show that they come out and mingle with everyone. And immediately they look at our group and they're like, you thought we were the Chili Peppers, didn't you? So having that in mind, we then end up spending a decent amount of money to see the Red Hot Chili Peppers at the Weenie Roast,
okay,
that music festival in Irvine.
Yeah.
And so we're finally going to see them. We obviously bragged to everyone. And Flea comes out on stage, their bassist, and he's like, all right, what's up, guys? And we're super pumped up. We're double fisting beers. We're like, yes, we're finally going to see them. And Flea comes out and he's like, hey guys, you know, we love to rock from the depths of our soul, but Anthony's in an ambulance on the way to the hospital. And turns out he had an intestinal flu or something. And so anyways, we love you guys and we'll see you again. And now here's Weezer. So Weezer comes out, and I've always liked Weezer, nothing against them. But now it's almost like whenever I hear Weezer, it reminds me of a time when I was like, oh no. I think they opened with like Buddy Holly or something. Yeah, right. So now it reminds me of them. But they're great. Yeah, so anyways, long story short, yep. Like them. But you know, sometimes things happen.
I discovered Weezer late too. So
did you? Mm. What's some of your, what's like a favorite Weezer song?
Honestly, well, you know what? The one from a couple years ago, Everything Will Be All Right in the End, that, I mean, I don't know that it had many hits off it. Back to the Shack, I think, was the single off that one, and produced by Rick Ocasek from The Cars. But it's just fantastic.
Yeah. They've been around for a long time.
Yeah. Is it 20 years now, maybe?
Yeah. When any band that can exist that long and is still touring and still putting out music, to me, is very impressive and just obviously a testament to they love what they do.
Yeah. And he doesn't care. He doesn't, you know, he is, Rivers Cuomo is completely unconcerned with being cool or hip or what anybody else thinks. Do you know what their new single is?
Huh.
It is a faithful, almost note-for-note cover of Africa by Toto.
Really?
Yeah.
I'll have to listen to it.
Oh, it's great.
That's awesome.
And
it's great
not,
song.
It's not ironic. He's not doing it to like make fun of Toto.
Yeah.
He likes the song. They like the song, and they did this like very faithful cover of it.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
That's sweet.
Who else would do that? Nobody.
Oh, I like that. You know, I need to get that out of my brain about Weezer because I like them.
Yeah. No, they're great.
I'll listen to them today on the way home. So. When you're at A&M, and then you went on to a different music company, didn't you?
Yeah, I went to another record company. I went to CBS at that time, and then ended up working at a company called Taxi, which is a place that helps independent musicians and songwriters get their music into film and TV and record companies and so forth.
That's right. Okay, so I tried to like do a little bit of reading on your background, and that actually sort of reminds me of what you're doing with Garage East Festival. Like, I feel like there's kind of parallels there, sort of taking little guys and trying to bring them in front of people.
That's correct. I didn't really realize it until we were already underway, and I kind of looked back over my shoulder and said, you know, there's a lot of parallels between going out and finding new bands and going out and finding new winemakers. There's something about, you know, as a fan, when you find a band in a club before they have a hit record, you feel like you're a part of it. You feel like you had something to do with it, and you did.
Yeah.
And so you have a sense of ownership when they go on and have a big hit. And you can, of course, lord it over everyone who found them after you did. The same is kind of true of small wineries, in that there's something that really connects you to these winemakers when you meet them early, and then they go on to bigger success or some big score in a wine magazine, or you know, some of them get these. Their production is so small that they sell it out just to their allocation lists. People that are on their list, their club list, it all goes to them, and you have to wait to get on their list. So some of them are like that.
Gotcha. What came first, the Garage East Festivals or Hoi Polloi Winery?
They kind of happened at the same time. I was making wine literally in a garage with my partners, Ted Behlendorf and Dan Anderson. And we were literally making wine in a garage, non-commercially.
Yeah.
And as at the same time that I was starting the festivals.
Whose idea was it to go from, we'll just make it to drink it, versus, we should make this into a business?
You know, it was kind of a mutual decision, but it was, having been running the Garage East Festivals for a few years at that point, I felt like I was getting to know what was succeeding and what wasn't. You know, we were getting really good fruit, again, because we'd made a lot of friends, and we were getting fruit that other people would maybe have a harder time getting,
right.
But we were able to get. And those winemakers and growers that we were getting our fruit from were also very generous and mentoring us through the process. Yeah. So that accelerated our development in a big way. And I was also able to see in other ways what wineries were succeeding and why, in terms of marketing, in terms of the wine they were making and so forth. So, you know, the wine was coming out good. And I felt like, you know, we were all getting a handle on the business that we could make it work. So,
Will you talk about hoi polloi, the meaning of that?
Hoi polloi means, first of all, I always thought it meant the elite, the upper crust. I'm hobnobbing with the hoi polloi.
Is that Vietnamese?
No, it's actually Greek. Oh. And it also turns out I had it 180 degrees wrong. It means the great unwashed, the common people, the riffraff, if you will. We thought, oh, well, that's just much better for us anyway.
Yes.
So the reason that we chose the name was because there's three of us that make the wine. We sort of became known in Paso and in the wine community as the Stooges. And we referred to ourselves as the Stooges, so did others. And but when it came time to go commercial, we couldn't be the Stooges anymore for a couple of reasons. You know, no one would take us seriously, for one thing, and copyright being the other. And so we wanted something Stooge-related if we could find it. And Hoi Polloi was the name of a Three Stooges movie.
And, oh, nice.
Which was later remade as Trading Places with Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy. And it's the story of wealth and poverty, you know, where these rich guys take a rich guy and they make him poor, and they take a poor guy and they make him rich, and they have a bet, and it's sort of about genetics versus environment, what is the nature of wealth and poverty. So there were too many metaphors in all these stories for us to ignore, and Hoi Polloi is the name of our winery now.
You had to go with it.
Yeah.
So how long is... Actually, two questions. So you said that to make good wine, you need good grapes, and you were fortunate enough to kind of make friends with growers, I'm assuming, and kind of able to get in there. How hard is it just for someone who's going to open a small winery, just start to get into the business, how hard is it to find good grapes?
Not as hard as you would think. I mean, there's good fruit out there. You know, there's
just kind of word of mouth, I guess.
Yeah, you just gotta put some energy into it, you know, but there's, you know, there are newsletters where you can look and sort of industry and trade websites and so forth.
And what are the qualities of a good grape?
How deep into the weeds do you want to get here?
Mediumish.
Okay, so well, let's put it this way: a lot of people say, "Well, how come your wine is $50 and I can buy a $10 bottle, you know, at Costco or something?"
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Generally speaking, okay, if bulk wine or, you know, large production wine is often made or grown in a vineyard where it is, the vines are left to produce as much fruit as they will on their own, and that might be 15 tons an acre, 10 or 15 tons an acre. And then it's harvested by a machine and on and on. So it's a sort of a big kind of industrial process. The kind of fruit that we get and that most of the wineries get at the Garagiste festivals, the growers will go through the vineyard at some point during the season, not too far from now, and they will literally drop half of the fruit on the ground. They'll just cut the clusters off to reduce the yield down to, let's say, 3, 4, 5 tons an acre. What it does is it concentrates the flavor in the remaining bunches. But it means instead of being able to sell 15 tons per acre, you're now only able to sell 4 or 5 tons an acre, and you paid human beings to go through and perform this manual labor in dropping the fruit.
Right.
And then when it comes time to pick, it's a manual pick. So you're sending people through to cut the fruit out, and somebody else is following them, and they're throwing away trash and leaves and what they call MOG, material other than grapes, pulling that out. So it's a much more labor-intensive process.
Gotcha.
For the better fruit.
Yeah, which I'm assuming is more money.
Yep.
To buy.
Yep.
Wow. So what's the turnaround time from harvest to bottle for you guys? And has that, you know, shortened since you started?
It is, well, it's lengthening because now we've got some wine in the pipeline so we can wait. But it depends on the wine. But, you know, typically it's 1 to 2 years, maybe more like 16, 18 months to 24 to 30 months is more like it. So a Cabernet, we'll probably spend 2 years in the barrel. A Pinot Noir, on the other hand, we'll spend a year in the barrel.
Was it a big learning curve for you guys? I mean, just to go from enjoying wine to actually making wine seems like just all the stuff you're talking about. I feel like that would take a while to just kind of.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it just happens. It's just, you know, something we were picking it up. We were going to wine country a lot and talking to a lot of people. And again, Paso, Santa Barbara County, the Central Coast in particular, is a very, very warm and welcoming environment. It's a warm and welcoming industry. For people of our age to roll up there and go, hey, you know, we're here to make some wine. And great, sounds good. And, you know, we can get the fruit and they're helping us and they're loaning us stuff and teaching us stuff. You know, it's remarkable. And so we were able to learn a lot just by hanging around these very nice and generous people.
I like that. I was reading an article that was published a couple of years ago just talking about Ventura County in general. Mm-hmm. There was seemed like it had a decent sized community of smaller wineries, mm-hmm. and how they kind of all helped each other, mm-hmm. and some of the bigger there was a bigger corporation there that was like also trying to help them. I don't know, it just seemed good vibes.
It is. I tell people it's the wine industry is everything I thought the music industry was going to be. I thought the music industry was going to be all these really nice people really doing what they love to do.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, but the wine industry actually is like that. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, it is. It's great.
Do you think that other industry, like outside of Central California, people would say that about the wine industry? I mean, if you're in various parts of Europe, or like, do you feel like that's the consensus generally?
I don't think that anyone would know unless you were operating in it.
Multiple areas.
If you're operating in this area, and then then if you're meeting people personally, then you see it and you experience it.
Fair point. I feel like I was watching a couple of videos that you guys made for Hoi Polloi Winery, and it seems like you guys were just having fun. I think there was one where you were kind of opening your tasting room, mm-hmm. in Newhall, and you're like putting up drywall or something, taking a sip, and you kind of have like good music going in the background. It just looked like fun.
We try to have fun. That's what it's all about. That's why we're doing this.
Yeah.
And if we wanted to do something that wasn't fun, we would have gone to college or something. But
yeah. Do your families help with the winery? Or is it kind of just...
I force my sons to help us do physical labor time to time. Yes. No, but they're helpful when we need them, yeah.
I guess in learning about what you do and these smaller micro wineries, I started to kind of go down a rabbit hole reading about how hard it is to sell wine. Mm-hmm. In general, mm-hmm. the three-tier system started, I mean, I knew that there was regulations on alcohol and selling it, and depending on where you are, makes a difference in what state you're in. But the three-tier system is, in a nutshell, it started after Prohibition, right?
Yes.
To basically make it more difficult to sell alcohol.
To remove the producers one step or more from the consumers.
So you guys can't just, and then with the creation of the internet, like you couldn't just, like someone in Kentucky can't just buy your bottles of wine, right?
Right.
California is different in that you can buy stuff in California.
Yeah, if you're licensed in California, you can ship and sell anywhere in California. But if you want to sell to a state outside of California, the winery has to go get a license in that state, each state. And each state has different requirements, and you got to pay a fee, you got to fill out all their paperwork, and it's arcane and horrible, and you know, it's for a winery of our size, we just don't do it.
I mean, I feel like unless you're, you know, Gallo or like Kendall Jackson, one of those big companies, there's no way you could. If you have to pay to sell in each state, I mean, that just seems like a giant cost.
Yeah, right. And especially with, again, in in small production wineries, if you can sell it all in California, that's what you do. You know, some people will, if they have a connection somewhere, you know, sometimes they'll have a distributor or a friend in Texas or, you know, Indiana, wherever it is, and then they'll focus on that area and continue to supply that area. But it's, other than that, wineries of our size will focus primarily on direct-to-consumer sales.
Gotcha. What would be the process if you were to ever go onto a store shelf? How? What would you have to do?
I guess it depends on the store, but you would need, you know, we don't even do it.
Right.
So I'm not sure I'm the one to ask. You know, there's, you know, Garage East wineries are never really going to be in supermarkets. Okay, when you stand one of those supermarket wine aisles where it looks like you're looking at 1,000 different wines, those 1,000 different wines, 1,000 different labels are basically about 4 or 5 large corporations with all these sub-labels.
It's like the cereal aisle.
Right, right, it is. And so we just don't make enough wine to satisfy a distributor who's supplying giant outlets like that. They're not interested in carrying. We don't have enough, mm-hmm. period. So what that does is it frees the micro winery to not worry about. They don't have to worry about the market. No one at the Garage East Festival is making wine for the marketplace. Mm-hmm. They're making the wine they want to drink and the wine they're passionate about. And in my opinion, this makes for the best wine out there, because these are great winemakers, many of whom have jobs at larger wineries, and this is their personal side project kind of thing. It's all commercial wineries now. It's not; these are not amateurs. But they're not worrying about, is a market going to like this? Is a distributor going to like this? They're saying, I want to make Terroir de Go. You know, to this day, I'm still finding new varietals at the Garage East Festival that I didn't know about.
Gotcha.
And made in every style.
So maybe they're blending things that aren't typically blended, or just there's more room for experimentation.
Absolutely.
Versus if you're working for something and things become, I guess, a little bit more homogenized.
Absolutely. It's, you know, you take a large winery, a supermarket wine. Their one of their objectives is to make sure that their wine tastes the same every year. And always taste the same. It's like going into a chain restaurant, okay? You know, you want to buy a bottle of whatever, X popular wine. You're buying that because you know what it's going to taste like, for the same reason you go into Chili's or McDonald's or whatever it is, okay? Small winemakers, we don't care that it's the same. It's cool that it's different every year. That difference is kind of what we're all about. And so the way that that sameness is achieved by the larger winery is through making wine to formula, largely. Okay, they know, you know, it needs to be at this pH and picked at this Brix and has this much, you know, total acidity, and they have, you know, so they can adjust those things to make sure they hit those numbers and to hit that formula, and keep it the same every year. It's and don't get me wrong, some of this stuff is great every year. You know, it's some of the well-known stuff is really great. But the small winery, the Garage East winery, doesn't have to worry about that. And for me, it makes for more interesting wine.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if that's something you're really... If wine is your passion, I can see where this would be just a really fun endeavor to be able to have freedom in that way.
Yeah.
Wine is such an interesting product to me, just like from as a consumer, because when you see it on the grocery store shelf, it all looks the same. And there's no way to really sample it unless you go to, like, if you're just at a Ralph's or, you know, just picking up a bottle, and you can't sample it. It's like there's nothing, I don't know. It's so I guess in that way it can be a little bit intimidating and overwhelming because there's much.
So that's why you end up buying a bottle. Oh, I know this name. I've had this before, so I'm going to buy this because I've had it before. Otherwise, you're committing your money to the purchase of something you may not like and you know nothing about.
Yeah.
So nobody does that. Nobody wants to do that or has the, you know, that kind of money to throw away on just experimenting bottle by bottle. I guess some do. I don't. But that's what is so great about an event like the Garage East Festival, because you don't have to do that. you can sample, as you say, from, we're going to have 48 wineries there, over 200 wines, something like 25 or 30 different grape varietals. And so you can go from table to table and winery to winery and taste these wines and find the ones that you like, find the styles that you like, the grapes that you like, and the ones that you don't, and all for the price of a ticket, you know, which is, you know, similar to the price of a bottle or two. And it's the greatest place to learn, whether you know a lot or whether you know a little.
Yeah, it's cool. And that sort of reminds me of, I guess, similar to a farmer's market where you're standing in front of the person who grew it, or in this case, made it, you know, and you can kind of talk to them. Anytime, I'm one of those suckers for, if I watch a documentary about the owner of a company and they seem very passionate and genuine about what they're talking about, I don't even care if I like it that much. I'm more into buying the product.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. And that's one thing that, you know, there's a lot of wine events out there. And one thing about ours that's a little different is that it's only the winemakers and or owners that pour at the Garagistes Festival. And we limit our ticket sales so that the ratio of tasters to wineries is low enough that you actually have a chance to talk to that winemaker, and they have a chance to talk to you and tell their story a little bit, that, you know, you don't have to wait in the, some of these events, there's, you know, it's a huge drunk fest and there's a bunch of tents out in a field and you're standing in line. And then when you get up to the front, they've hired a model or something to pour the wine. This is different. This is, like you said, much more like a farmer's market where you're meeting the creator.
Yeah.
And these people, you know, a lot of people think the wine industry is snobby, and I guess maybe there's some portions of it that are, but one area that is free of snobs pretty much is the winemakers themselves. They love to tell their story. They love to educate people who don't know or want to learn, and they tend to be the nicest people around.
That's cool. Garage yeast is a term that was used in an area of France to kind of denigrate people who were sort of making it sometimes in the garage, but sort of they didn't have as much money. They weren't in this like fancy
the Chateau.
Yeah. Do you think that's still that the meaning behind that term? Do you think that's still the case in France?
I don't know.
Or do you feel like people have sort of flipped
it? Yeah, I think it's flipped. I mean, you know, it's I don't know if the story is, you know, how true or apocryphal it is, but the story is that Robert Parker, the big wine critic,
was
in France sometime in the, I don't know, 70s, I think, and was visiting one of the big chateaus, and he said, I heard there's some people down the road that are making some interesting wine, and the owner of the chateau is dismissively said, oh, you don't want to taste their wine. They are just garagistes working in their garage. And the story is that Parker went down there and it was great and he liked it. And now that started the flip of the meaning of the word to being more of a badge of honor of, you know, a renegade artisan and so forth.
Yeah.
You know, they're very strict winemaking rules in France. Okay. You can only pick on these certain dates. You can only blend these certain grapes together. All this stuff that you can and can't do. And the garagistes in France, as I understand it, were just ignoring those rules and just doing what they wanted to do.
I like that.
Mm-hmm.
Rule breakers. I really like that. Mm-hmm. I like how they took ownership of something that was intended to be mean.
Mm-hmm.
And they just, you know, took it over. This, my high school had a mascot for the men were the Mustangs and the girls were the Amazons. And it became that way because in the 70s, the girls' basketball team was doing really well one season. And the guys, for whatever reason, were kind of, I don't know, maybe they were intimidated by this. So they trashed the girls' locker room and wrote, you guys are a bunch of Amazons. Like, obviously, in a mean way.
Yeah, right.
And they were like, you're right, we are Amazon. So the mascot stuck. And I don't know, I always admire stuff like that.
Did they ever play the boys' team?
Yeah, I don't know. But that would have been awesome if they did and they kicked their you-know-what.
Yeah.
So when you first did the first festival was in Paso Robles, right? And you're looking for, it's only small winemakers. And what does that mean? How much are they producing each year?
We set our sort of arbitrary bar at 1,500 cases a year. It doesn't mean that if you're making 2,000 cases or 3,000 cases a year that you're making bad wine. Nothing of is that's not even close to true. It's just we wanted to have people that were the smallest of the small because they also needed the most help reaching their audience. These are very small operations, mom and pop operations, and don't have as much time and energy or resources to market their wines the way they'd like to. So part of what our mission is to bring an audience to them.
Gotcha.
And help them sell their wine.
So that's probably one of the biggest challenges for someone who's doing, for a garagista, smaller winery, is it's so hard to reach people, mm-hmm. consumers.
Absolutely.
Huh. Yeah, I can see where that, I mean, that would be difficult. How, out of curiosity, so if you're a large scale production making a ton of wine each year, does that necessarily, I guess, impact, well, I guess we kind of mentioned this earlier, talking about how like smaller wineries can have more freedom, but larger scale, let me go back. Is there a particular larger winery that you're a fan of?
You know, it's funny. If I can take a quick little side trip here. At Hoi Polloi, if we've only done one thing, we've succeeded in drinking exactly, making the wine we want to drink. And that's pretty much all I drink. I probably shouldn't be admitting this anymore, but this, I pretty much only drink my own wine anymore.
You should.
And look, I love a giant Napa cab with a steak. You know, I do a big oaky Napa cab, ripe, you know, those can be great.
Are there a lot of, so let's say some of the bigger wine companies, are they actively looking for smaller wine companies in that area and then buying them up quickly?
It's happening, yes, but not probably wineries of our size. This is microscopic
gotcha.
In the industry
it needs
sense.
To be more medium sized places.
Yeah.
Okay.
And for huge money.
Big money.
Oh, gosh. You know The Prisoner? You've heard of that wine, The Prisoner?
I think I've seen the label.
Okay, so
they're in, like, Prisoner's in bigger grocery stores, aren't they?
Yeah, okay. So it's, I think the guy's name is Oren Swift. Somebody bought, he doesn't even have, like, vineyards or a winery, as I understand it. They just bought that brand name for a nine-figure price. I forget if it was $100 or $200 million, something like that.
Wow.
Just for that brand. There's a Pinot Noir called Meomi, M-E-O-M-I, same thing happened there. Somebody came in and bought that for hundreds of millions of dollars or thereabouts. And it certainly happens.
I feel like if I was starting a winery, I wouldn't want to open it in my personal name. I guess if I intended to sell it, because then it would be taken out of your hands if you did sell it and then your name was out there.
Yeah.
You know? Maybe not.
You wouldn't care at that point.
Yeah. You got money to spend. Can you make a profit as a micro winery?
I'll let you know.
Okay. Gotcha. With the Garagies festivals, what's, I guess, the overall goal of doing them? I know that it's kind of helps get people in front of these winemakers that otherwise wouldn't really know about them. Is that the overall goal to you?
Yeah. My partner Stuart McLennan, who lives in Paso, who has his own winery called Golden Triangle, which is absolutely worth trying. He and I were discussing, he knew about all these small wineries in Paso. I knew some, he knew more. And these were the wines that we liked to drink. And these guys were friends of ours, guys and girls. And no one had gathered them under one umbrella. You know, there are organizations for Bordeaux grapes and organizations for Rhone grapes and Pinot Noir and area groups and so forth. But nobody had ever gathered micro wineries under one umbrella before. And so we wanted to do that. We wanted to be the ones to shine a light on this kind of winemaker. And we kicked around some ideas, you know, a video series or a website. We thought, you know, what about a festival? Because then, you know, we can start that right away. And Paso is a very festival-friendly town. And so that's how we started. And yes, we wanted to bring these winemakers to an audience and bring an audience to the winemakers. We're kind of a matchmaker in that way. Both sides are happy if we do our job well. We now have about 600 small wineries in our orbit.
Wow.
From all over the state. And so we're not a trade organization. We're a nonprofit. We have a scholarship fund at Cal Poly University in San Luis Obispo, the Garagis Festival Scholarship Fund, which we give scholarships to deserving enology students there. And we've always been a nonprofit. We've always donated our proceeds to Cal Poly, to their winery program and now the scholarship. So that's our main function, is to raise funds for the scholarship. But in doing that, we are almost a de facto trade organization for these small wineries. You know, we don't lobby and things like that for them, but we do bring them an audience. And, you know, both sides of the equation have grown over the years. The wineries, the 600 wineries we have now, and, you know, thousands and thousands of people who are fans of these kinds of wineries, who like to make new discoveries of under the radar winemakers.
Yeah.
And those people fit perfectly with each other.
In addition to doing podcasts here, how have you guys been able to, like, even get the word out that, hey, this is happening?
Garage East?
Yeah. Just the internet?
A lot of press. Melanie Weber is one of, there's four of us that do this, that put these events on. And Melanie's been key since the beginning, and she's a great publicist. And we have a unique story. Nobody else is doing anything like this. And we've grown since, I think, did I already tell you, we do four a year?
No.
Okay, so from the first year in Paso, 8 years ago, we now still do the one in Paso. We do one in San Ynez in Santa Barbara County. We do this, our fifth one in LA next Saturday, July 21st. And one in Sonoma now. So it has really grown. And, it, you know, as we grow, the story is still a good one, because it is, nobody else is doing anything like it.
Yeah.
So we do a lot of, you know, don't do that much advertising. We try and get the story out there.
Yeah, I mean, like I was saying before, I watched a documentary about the owner of Patagonia.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of his name right now. But anyways, and learning his story, it just made me want to go online and buy mm-hmm. a Patagonia sweatshirt or, you know, whatever, because it's like you can clearly see there's passion and a lot of purpose behind what he has been doing or what you guys are doing, I think.
There's certainly a lot of passion behind it. You know, nobody's getting rich.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unfortunately.
I noticed you guys have a lot of Syrahs.
Yeah.
Is that your favorite kind of wine, or is there a reason for that?
Yeah. I mean, if I had to pick a favorite, I'd say Syrah. This is the same as true of Dan and Ted, my partners. Syrah is an interesting grape in that it is very different from place to place where it's grown, that is.
Okay.
It's climatic conditions and soil and so forth. You know, whereas a cab, you know, it's kind of always a cab. Syrah can be wildly different when grown in a cool climate versus a warm climate and everywhere in between. So we like exploring that. We have right now, we have four different single vineyard Syrahs and a fifth one in the barrel.
Oh, wow.
So from Sonoma, from the Russian River in Sonoma, to the west side of Paso Robles, to Ballard Canyon in Santa Barbara County, to the Santa Rita Hills in western Santa Barbara County, where it's very cool. And so we make four different single vineyard Syrahs, and then we do a blend of some of those. And we're probably insane for doing so. It is a very, it's a marketing challenge. You know, it's something we're doing because we, because we're geeks and we love it and we like, you know, it's kind of our thing.
Yeah.
But there's an old saying in the wine business that, the joke is, what's the difference between Syrah and syphilis? You can get rid of a case of syphilis. and here we are with 5 different Syrahs. Okay, so wish us luck.
That's cool. It's kind of like the mystery bean in the Jelly Belly box. You know, you don't know what you're going to get necessarily,
there you go.
Right?
Yeah.
That's cool. I mean, that plays into what you were saying about the freedom of, you know, not having to produce for a bigger distributor or whatever that's demanding this consistency.
Right.
You know. That's cool.
Yeah, they're very different.
How challenging is it to... So there's so many online subscription services for wines, like Monthly, Wink, or Tasting Room, or whatever. There's a jillion. How hard is it to get into one of those? Or is it kind of same story to where they need a particular amount each month?
Yeah, I don't know that much about them. There's one that is kind of doing, you know, Paso and Santa Barbara wineries. And, you know, from my understanding, it's... There's an economic equation to it that you have to have enough wine that you're willing to dispose of a bunch at a pretty low price.
Gotcha.
In order to get it out there.
Gotcha.
We're not in that position yet.
Gotcha. Yeah. I feel like those are, in the past three or four years, they're everywhere now. There's so many companies doing that.
Yeah.
Which in a way is maybe a good thing because it's probably introducing more people to the kinds of wine that they like.
Right.
You know?
It's a process. There's, you know, our events are not... filled with 20-year-olds. You know, nothing against them. I wouldn't have been there at that age either. But it's a process to get to the point where you're enjoying wine like this, where you've, you know, it's... God, yeah. This sounds horribly snobby, what I'm saying. How can we... press rewind and go back on that. but yeah. It is. It's kind of a, you know, it's like you...
Yeah.
There's stuff to learn.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It takes time.
Do you feel kind of, if you're tasting a wine and you give qualities to it that you're tasting, does that make you feel snobby? Like if you say, oh, this is very earthy or, you know, it's kind of tannic. Isn't tannic
one of them? Yeah, that's a thing.
Does that make you feel snobby?
Yeah, sure it does. It makes me feel far superior to people who don't know that. No, I don't know. It's just our language, you know? I can't even do that stuff where like, I pick up notes of cassis and anise and lavender. I can't do that stuff. Other people can do that. No. My partner does that. I'm highly suggestible. You can say anything to me and I'll go, oh, you're right.
Oh,
it does taste like that.
Same. That's exactly how I am. Do you feel like it would be harder in 2018 to start what you're doing or to start a kind of micro brewery?
Well, I don't know about the micro brewery thing because I'm not doing it. I will say there are times when I wish that's what we had done, a brewery, because you can get your product on the shelf in like 4 months as opposed to 2 years.
Oh, right, yeah.
And there's a huge difference there. In terms of the investment, you know, that we had to put up to, because we have to make as much wine right now as we expect to need in 2 years.
Yeah, that's so hard to anticipate.
Yes, it is. So.
Gotcha.
You know, and I would say that probably, you know, I don't know about the saturation factor, but, you know, beer's an easier, there's less barrier to entry for a brewery in terms of the marketplace, right? It's like, it's still the most expensive six is going to be what, $12 or something,
yeah,
right?
Not a lot.
So your market's a little bigger.
What's your favorite kind of beer to drink?
You know, I'm kind of I like micro wineries and macro beers.
Gotcha.
I drink a lot of 805, it being a Paso a wine or a beer. I'm a lager pilsner guy.
Gotcha.
I'm not much into the super hoppy stuff. It gets too cloying.
I'm into the IPAs.
You are?
Yeah. Only because my husband was obsessed with them, so I just started drinking them by like proxy, you know, and now I'm into it. But
what do you, I mean, can you have two? Can you have three? You know,
no, but that's kind of my style. Okay. Kind of like two beers and okay. All right, I'm good. You know what I mean? Yeah, but yeah. I mean, if I would just get like Bud Light if I was going to chug, you know, yeah. Have a bunch.
There you go.
I guess, you know. Are you going to sell out the festival in Santa Monica?
It looks like it. We're on a very quick pace. Oh. Yeah.
So, okay. If someone is going to buy tickets, it's on your website, mm-hmm. the GarageEastFestival.com.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And then, so if you're in California, you can order wine off of your website.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, if you're in, you know, a place like probably Alabama, no.
No, probably not. but yeah, if you want to buy tickets to the festival, it's GarageEastFestival.com, and that's GarageEaste. GarageEastFestival.com. Tickets are available there. I would get them quickly if you're interested in coming. And if you want to buy Hoi Polloi wine or Golden Triangle wine, you can do that at You can find, Google this, Hoi Polloi wine.
Thank God for Google.
HOIPOLLOI is Hoi Polloi.
And they have fun videos on their website.
that's Dan Anderson. That's my partner, Dan. He's the video guy. He loves making those.
I liked it. There is some good music to it, like mm-hmm. some good soundtracks. I was like, I feel like this guy is into music. And turns mm-hmm. out you worked in the music industry yeah. for a while. Okay, well, Doug, thank you very much for coming in, sharing your info and, you know, making the trek from Studio City.
Thanks for having me. I hope you'll come to the festival next weekend. And Patrick, you're welcome to come too if you like.
Oh, yes. I'm going to finish this too.
Yeah,
cheers.
Me too. All right.
Cheers, everyone.
Thanks again.
Thank you for listening to the Olympic and Bundy podcast. If you'd like to taste Doug's wine, you can do so at the Hoi Polloi Winery Tasting Room in Old Town Newhall, right on Main Street. I'm sure he would love it. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a 5-star rating and review of what episode you like most. That always helps a bunch. Once again, I'm Kelly Taylor, and thank you very much for listening.